Thanks, Brad. We are going to take questions from the committee members first, then we will pass the questions to the rest of the audience. Let's start with Michael.
As part of this one, on the last presentation, those of us who work in the university world know a lot about human subjects protocols and human subjects restrictions. Are there specific, I guess, policy guidelines or standards or any sort of advice that you would issue or give us about some of this re-identification problem that you were just talking about?
Sure. Wait, before I do that, can you clarify your question a little bit? Because are you asking how this information should be used from a regulatory
perspective? Well, I'm thinking more from your perspective. So you work in the biomedical area. Are there regulatory standards? Would you recommend that we use things like university protocols for human subjects? Or what would you recommend in terms of thinking about the public release of voter registration information? After all, it's a transparency issue in democracy. But on the other hand, certainly I wasn't really thinking about how these kind of databases could be linked back to other databases, and people then could be re-identified, and other privacy issues may arise.
Well, I think it's a combination of issues. So first of all, if it's legally required from a transparency issue to put this information in the public realm, I don't think it's necessarily the public, the voter registration lists that need to be controlled from a linkage issue. I think it's actually the information that holds more sensitive information. So if you think of this from the medical community, one of the things that we're doing at Vanderbilt is we're developing de-identified data sets of clinical information that we want to be able to share into the public realm for large-scale research purposes. But we need to take into account that there are these voter registration lists that exist. And so if we know that it could be linked to that, we can use that to say, okay, what do we need to suppress out of our databases? And so in a sense, having this type of information in the public realm isn't such a bad thing, because it gives anybody who has other types of sensitive information an idea of what the population actually looks like. And so it's a secondary use of voter registration list, but I think it actually is helping us. But if I was to take it from the perspective of voter registration history, that's a different issue. And I think that there are unintended inferences that do exist in those data sets, as I've already shown, and that we can evaluate whether or not they exist before the information is disclosed. In a sense, you kind of have conflicting policies, right? You have the first one that says it's got to be in the public realm, and then this other one that says, well, you shouldn't be able to identify an individual's vote. Well, which one takes precedent? And I think that needs to be determined before this information gets put out the door.
I'd like to kind of jump in. I think that's a very important question that needs to be addressed, because again, it gets back to what are we protecting and why are we protecting it. Would everybody on the panel agree that being registered to vote and the act of voting itself is essentially a public affirmation of a private act? In other words, it's when you register to vote, you say, I am registered to vote and I am prepared to participate politically and electorally. And then by voting, you're saying, I have voted, I have participated. At a very basic level, that those two acts are public affirmation of private acts. Would everybody basically agree with that?
One exception, and that is that you may register as an independent rather than as a Republican or a Democrat.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but the very fact that you have registered to vote, it states that I, Glenn Newkirk, am a registered, I am prepared to participate electorally by the fact I've registered to vote. And then when I go vote, it states that I, Glenn Newkirk, have participated, I have voted. I get my little I voted flag, which I guess theoretically violates my privacy in the sense that although I voluntarily do it, and I put it on my lapel, and I say, so public affirmation of private act.
I certainly have no objection to the I have voted tag. However, I do not go around wearing a tag on my other lapel with my address and birthday.
Couldn't agree more, but the issue is then I have voted in 10 out of the last 12 elections is also a public affirmation of private acts over a period of time. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think the public record is important. I have a friend who used to live in North Carolina, moved to California for something like 15, 18 years, went back to North Carolina and said that he needed to re-register, and the registrar said, oh, that's interesting. You voted in every election in the past 20 years. Somebody had voted for him, unbeknownst to him. So I think when we talk about the database data mining, it is important to be able to track past records of having voted. On the other hand, I'm extremely wary of the third party, the ChoicePoint-like thing, where they go in and they data mine, and they say, hey, we've identified these seven guys named John Smith, all of them who had voted in the past 23 elections, and it must have been a fraud, when, in fact, there were 23 distinct John Smiths. So I believe that, again, the accountability issue is an important one here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of what I was getting at. And the data mining, again, we focused on a very fundamental element, that is name. And by nature of name, I guess I'm looking at it from most states I have worked in and large county jurisdictions. It's a given, and maybe it shouldn't be. I guess that's part of what we're discussing. But it's a given that unless you have a protected status in that state, and protected status is usually pretty easily defined. It might not be well administered, but it's pretty easily defined. Protected
state.
It does. It's person, state. That's right. Judges, law enforcement officials sometimes, drug enforcement officials sometimes, and frequently, and here's where you get into the interesting stuff, because that information is in the database, but it has to be essentially suppressed with a flag. And you're absolutely right, it differs from state to state. So all of a sudden, we just changed slightly the hurdle, because the fact that Newkirk is registered to vote, and that I've voted in every available opportunity since 1985, and they've started collecting data in the automated form, and they have my address, they have my gender, they have my, as far as public records, they have the fact that I have voted, which of course tells them all the districts that I live in.
Okay, now we agree with your hypothesis. What's your conclusion?
I would like to actually move to, I'd like to just cycle into the next question. Do you have a closing statement?
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. All I'm trying to get at is this information is out there, has been out there, and that what we really start to focus on is the protection against all that other personally identifiable information that you talked about. If my Social Security number is there, I guess my driver's license, that's pretty easy for anybody to get. So again, we get into the question of what is the real risk? And what are we trying to protect? And that's why I was saying we're in a unique area here, because voting and registering to vote are public affirmations that we make. It's the stuff that goes beyond that into the personally identifiable information that we really are going to have to focus on. That's all.
Thank you, Glenn.
Cross-linking, that's the problem, if you can draw inferences that way.
Yeah, I would like to pass the next question to Paula. Paula.
Okay, thank you. So, Peter, in your written testimony here, you mentioned that Arizona's internet registration is a mistake. You have like two lines, and so let me just say.
Oh, I didn't say it was a mistake.
Well, let me just say my question here.
Yeah.
So, currently, we have people going out to state fairs, handing out a registration form. Someone fills it in. That person either remembers to put it in the mail or doesn't. The form could be written legibly, often isn't. If it's not written legibly, if the clerk who's reading it, typing it in, can't even figure out what the address is, we have a real problem. So one of the solutions to that problem that I personally am in love with is the ability to register over the internet. I'm sorry, but I really think it'd be really neat to do that.
Okay.
And so tell me what ways, how we could make it secure to do that.
Good. You have misread my sentence, which says one of the things we should be concerned about is the improper, perhaps fraudulent use of internet registration. In parentheses, I say there are several examples where things are done. For example, Arizona allows internet registration with an electronic signature. I think that's a wonderful thing. Many other states provide application forms and other registration support online. I think that's a wonderful thing. Those are examples where you can constructively use the internet. On the other hand, when I get to things like internet voting, where you actually are submitting your vote over the internet, where somebody is standing over your shoulder and forcing you to vote for a particular candidate, there are improper uses of the internet, perhaps. And I'm just cautioning that if you are going to go toward internet registration, then there's a great deal, again, authentication, accountability, and various other things that need to go along with it. I'm not saying that internet registration is a bad idea. In fact, I think it's a wonderful idea if it can be done in a reasonable way. Now, what can make it a reasonable way? One of the problems today is that nobody on the internet knows you're a dog. That's the old cartoon from The New Yorker. You basically have very limited accountability, very little traceability. From my laptop, which is sitting over there logged in as me at the moment, somebody could have wandered up to it and done something that would look as if it had been done by me. There's no real accountability there. I think the idea of internet voting, as I say, is a wonderful idea. But if you're going to do it, you better have a lot of protection and oversight and accountability and identity authentication and things of that nature that go along with it. Otherwise, I can submit thousands of bogus registrations with perfectly valid cryptographic certificates that are in the name of somebody who doesn't exist. And I can provide documentation that supports a bogus birth certificate, for example. And I could have registered many, many people who are, in fact, non-existent. So the idea by itself is a wonderful idea. The implementation requires a great deal of care.
Peter, I would like to just kind of make a qualification to what you said. You said that you would have registered 1,000 people bogusly over the internet. I think probably what you meant to say was you can submit 1,000 applications to vote, register to vote, but they're not necessarily registered until they go through verification and confirmation processes.
That is correct.
In order for that to occur, you would have to resubmit by paper under just about every state that has any kind of law. You know, when they send back out the mailing to you and all that other wonderful stuff. So certainly, I'm not saying it wouldn't be possible to flip through one or two, but the apocryphal stories that are out there about dogs registering to vote are, again, you're talking about a it seems to me, again, if we look into it, there are far, far, far greater risks that we need to protect against than that kind of activity.
This is probably true. On the other hand, if you look at Michigan's co-mingling the DMV and the voter registration, suppose somebody dies and it's not recorded, but I happen to have his driver's license, and now I know enough information, and his birth certificate is already recorded somewhere, I don't need all that documentation. There might be a slippery slope here which says that it would be relatively easy to register somebody who does not exist or is no longer alive or whatever. But I think you're right. It's a question of, again, accountability and authentication and so on and verification to assure that there are not too many bogus requests. On the other hand, if anybody can do this, it puts an added burden on the authorities to have to verify things that in fact are bogus. And so that is by itself sort of a denial of service problem, where they're creating massive attempts to register that have to be adjudicated on an individual basis.
Well, I agree with that.
I would really like to get some more questions. If we end up with only three or four, I will have done a bad job as a moderator. Wendy.
Okay, I just, I come from the belief that anybody can commit a felony. I mean, you can go rob a bank, you can rob a convenience store, you can do any of these things. And so, you know, actually the number of people who attempt it in this process, in the registration process, is very low after 30 years. But we do need systems that assist us in identifying those, because we all agree there's no such thing as a perfect match to anything. We all agree that, you know, we can't read some of these, there'll be data entry errors. And I will say, as far as the internet registration process goes, there are things that would make it easier to identify fraud occurring. If I got 1,000 over the internet coming in from the same IP addresses, you know, and IDing me, it is much more of a flag than somebody dropping off 1,000 voter registration forms that I have to go through and try and find some commonality to. So I would argue there are some things in those type of electronic transmissions where we can detect things better than the paper flow that gets dumped in my office. And yes, and that is true, but that's what we need to find out from experts like you, not all of the things that can go wrong, but what steps do we need to take to ensure those things don't. Very specific steps, not just say this will happen. But, you know, I'm an election official, and for the last 8 years, all I've heard is all the things that can go wrong with voting systems, with registration systems. I need very specific things on what I need to do to protect against those going wrong. So write them up and submit them.
Real ID and biometrics, for example.
Any other comments here? We have any more questions from the committee?
Yeah, I just want to come back to something that I was saying earlier, which is that I don't think that all of the people who work in security and privacy have a full handle of what the information is going to be used for or how it's going to be used. And so if it was a clear documentation across the states of how the, if you're going to move to a online registration process, it makes it easier to determine what the potential threats would be. Just being able to say we're going to put this model on the internet, what are the threats, is really difficult to determine what all the potential threats are. So you might be able to, because I could pontificate for a second, I could say that you might be able to detect if everything came from the same IP address. And so if we know that's a problem, so then somebody just starts rotating IP addresses on you. And you might be able to say, okay, well then we could use, well, the time between registration requests. It's a slippery slope, and it's just a matter of saying, well, we might be able to defend against this if we say, okay, this is exactly how the information is going to be collected and used. How do we defend in that one scenario? I'm just saying.
Okay. So I'd like to take a question. I mean, I'd like to ask a question, and then we'll turn this over to the remainder of the group. I'm going to have to package two questions into one in interest of time, and then a short response would be great. Jim, you mentioned that voter registration databases are high-value targets because of large collections of personal info. My concern is that the degree of which voter registration data has already, it's already out of the tube. Thousands and thousands of copies of this are out. Even if you turned it off today, there's tremendous amounts of data out there, and maybe people in this room know that, but maybe many consumers don't. So I'm just throwing that out there as an observation. It's hard to put that toothpaste back in that tube. And then my second question is that if you want to improve matching, one option one has is to triangulate against secondary data. When the registrar's office is trying to confirm something, they could look in the phone book that sits behind them. Does that mean they can load the entire phone book to see? if they can go to LexisNexis to figure out how to resolve some ambiguity, it might lead them to think they could just be ingesting a lot of data, so call this triangulating to try to improve accuracy. And so this is more data matching against more data sets, and I'm just opening that up as, you know, comments on that. So let's keep this just a couple minutes, main thoughts, then like go to the audience.
Okay, in my slides, which I didn't really have time to talk about, I am in favor of using these secondary data sources for validation, but I think you ought to be very careful about not sucking them in and making them accessible either publicly or to hackers or whatever. Use them, but don't store them.
Oh, that's good.
But comment on that. You have to go back to the original source, though. There are mirrors all over the internet that do not have the updated versions, and in many cases, corrections have been very painfully entered into the original source and are never picked up elsewhere. This is a huge problem. The second is that the telephone book is not very reliable. There's no authentication whatsoever, other than you've given a credit card or something. It could be a bogus credit card, but you're paying for a yellow page entry or whatever. There's no assurance that that's a genuine business, or it's not a shill or a front for a Russian mafia operation or God knows what else. So the idea of cross checking with the telephone book worries me seriously.
Pick real property. I mean, it was just an example.
Real property is probably records. A better example.
Sure, I would agree.
On the other hand, you have all sorts of front corporations that are hiding their identities in the real estate business.
Okay, that's good. Let's go ahead, Glenn.
I guess a couple of comments about the notion of voter registration databases being high-value targets. Number one, I don't think that's a given. I think that's a question as to whether they are high-value targets or not. I don't know if anybody is in there from Oregon, perhaps the election official who spoke earlier. I don't know if John Lindback is there, but he will know, you know, one of the great statements I've heard about voter fraud came from the guy who really implemented the mail-in. When I say implemented, I mean at the ground level, the statewide mail-in voting in Oregon. His comment was, and I think it's a good one, it's one we need to keep in mind, which goes back to the whole idea of doing real risk assessments here. His statement was, if you have a choice between robbing a 7-Eleven in Oregon or committing voter fraud, you probably pick robbing the 7-Eleven. The reason is fairly simple. Number one, you're going to get more out of it. Number two, you're much less likely to get caught. And number three, if you do get caught robbing the 7-Eleven, even with a gun, the penalties are less than if you get caught committing voter fraud.
John Lindback is smiling.
Yes. Hi, John. I hope you can see me, but hello. And I think that's something we need to keep in our minds here, that, again, I don't think we should try to protect against all threats, because we can, again, the election official said, we can conjure up all kinds of threats. Again, from an economic point of view, we need to go back and look and say, what are the risks? What are the most likely threats, accurate and reliable information, and try to protect against those first and get the most bang for the buck that way.
Great, thanks. I'd like to now open this to audience questions. Do we have any? There we go. Hello, come on up.
Hello. Thank you very much for this presentation. You've mentioned linking the voter registration history with vote results ruining the privacy of the vote. I want to know what you thought about states like Maryland and Georgia, which have a smart card which links the registration database to the actual voting machines, which collect the actual vote of the individuals.
That question opens up a lot of cans of worms, I would say. First of all, we have a colleague who has broken essentially every smart card and identify the secret key of it and show how to forge them and all kinds of wonderful things. I'm a little bit leery of believing that the smart card is actually legitimate. The second is that if you trust a single point of authentication, presentation, you are now in the position where all sorts of things can happen. Now, this may look speculative to some of you, but it is the overly simplistic solution to a complex problem, where the mere possession of some piece of plastic over endows you with privileges that you might not otherwise get. So I think there's no simple answer to your question, but it requires a much lengthier discussion than we can do today.
I think just to comment on really quick, I think you addressed one problem, which is it you're trying to solve the authentication issue there in terms of people verifying who they are, but it doesn't solve the inference issue, which is once that information is disclosed beyond that individual's control. And so the smart card helps you with the security issue, but it doesn't necessarily help you with the privacy issue down the road.
And it does get back to real ID and biometrics and all that stuff that I thought Jeff was going to ask about, but he didn't.
Can I clarify? I think maybe the question was misinterpreted. My concern is that the identity of the voter can be linked to the outcome of the vote.
I'm sorry, but I'm from Maryland.
Yes.
The card actually contains the ballot cell that is to be used. It does not contain any personal information about that particular voter. What the election judge does, it checks the e-poll book. We use e-poll books. Checks and verifies that that is the correct person. And then they put the card in, and it actually just puts a ballot cell number on it. They walk over to the voting machine, and then it brings up the correct ballot cell for them to use. That's so.
Yeah, a lot of the direct recording systems have simply an authentication card that is handed to you. It has nothing to do with your personal identity. It just lets you in to vote. So if that's what you're thinking about, that's a completely different problem.
Now, okay. I think, I'm sorry, I'm Lily Coney with Epic. I think her point was that the ballot initiation process uses an electronic poll book, and the ballot activation card is inserted, and the ballot style is loaded on at that point, while it also takes the person out of the active voting file for that particular election. And then the card is ejected after it's initialized with the ballot and handed over to either the poll worker to walk the voter over, or the voter to walk over and put it into the voting machine. And it's a question of how dumb that card is. It may also contain the ballot initiation information, but the question is, does it have the capability to pick up anything else and link the voter with the ballot in the initiation process? So
that depends on the implementation.
Exactly.
And again, there are many, many different solutions to that one.
Exactly. Now, I do have a – oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to insert one comment, and then you can finish your question.
Okay. That was sorry.
Okay. I did want to say that NIST and the EAC has been addressing that in the voting system guidelines that are proposed. So if you want to comment on that, that's the appropriate body to do it, not here.
That's good. Okay.
Yes, I'm Lily with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. I wanted to thank the panelists for talking about the issue of privacy and transparency, but I wanted to be clear about the privacy consequences of voting. It's not whether you showed up and registered at a polling location or sent in an absentee ballot or applied for one. That's the information that may leak out to the public. When the I voted sticker that's on your lapel or on your clothes or the list that says you actually registered to participate in an election on election day, it doesn't say you actually went to a machine and cast a vote for any office or any item on the ballot itself. There's always a variant, a little degree of people, the number of people actually registered in election and the number of votes who've actually been cast, and won't get into all of that. But I wanted to talk about the attacks that are based on voter registration information. It's not just on the centralized list, which have privacy implications of their own. There are also attacks on voters themselves, based on having access to the information on voter registration lists. We hear caging, we hear about deceptive practices, we hear about ballot challenges against voters, whether they should be allowed to vote, whether they shouldn't be allowed to vote, whether they're legal voters or not, and it's all based on public access to that information. And I wanted to stress that transparency helps assure privacy, and I want to ask a question of the panel, whether using checksum and then log reports or auto reporting
voter registration systems can help identify when changes take place to verify that changes are appropriate, and there's some human interface going on to verify. Because yesterday there was some question about several hundred registrations disappearing that weren't identified until the election. Would checksum of implementation of checksum be useful in a situation where something happened and it didn't come to the attention of the human?
But I want to make sure we answer this real fast. We'll take one more question and then we'll be done. Okay.
I can be real quick. Checksums are insufficient. You need to know who made each change, when they made it, where they made it, and on what authority they made it.
And even worse than that, the checksum itself is corruptible by anybody who has insider access. So you need some sort of cryptographic seal, if you will. And as I said earlier, you need a sort of a complete, as Jim suggested, a complete accountability trail of what's going on. The deceptive practices that Billy mentioned is very, very important. There are lots of folks who use the voter registration database to make calls, for example, on the morning of the election to say that your precinct voting place has been changed. I'm sorry to report this, but we have to get you to go to a different precinct. This has happened on numerous occasions, and there is an example of the misuse of the data. And it's not a problem of the database itself. It's a problem that's external. And this brings me to the quick comment that privacy is a problem that is very often external to the technology. And we're back to the problem that you can't solve it in a technological way.
Okay, last question.
Another half hour, don't we?
No, we are done 1 minute ago, but I would like to get this question.
Yep. Thank you. My question, I'm Paul Miller from Washington State, and first wanted to clarify that it was not the Secretary of State's office that wanted the birth date released. That, and so my question ultimately is about balancing what is perceived as the public interest in transparency versus the privacy concern. And the to be specific, the birth date became public information after we had a very close 2004 election, and it was felt that the public had the right to be able to verify whether the people participating in an election were validly participating in an election. Without birth date, you couldn't check on felon lists, you couldn't check on other types of things. So I appreciate some discussion on how you balance those two.
I thank you for clarifying that. That's really helpful for me to know. One of the things that I think is important to determine is what the point is of voter registration lists. And I don't know if that needs to be taken up at the level of the state or if this needs to be taken up at a grander level than the state. Because if all you need it for is to just have some type of public representation of these are the people who exist and have verified that they're ready to vote, that's one thing. But if it's the list itself that needs to be used in the public realm for authentication purposes or for validation purposes, then that additional information may be necessary. But if it's not going to be used for validation purposes, then there's no reason in taking that information off the public table and just holding it within the centralized database and publishing to the public that says, this is the type of information that we have on you. If you want to validate it, or if you want to amend it, or if you want to do anything like that, then you have the ability to do so. So it's a matter of the use case.
Okay, I would like to thank my panel. Thank you very much, and we have a 30-minute break.
Glenn, don't go away. I want to make a comment to you before we hang up. I'm sorry, I was working with the old, I'm making my notes on the old schedule, which gave us another.
Thank you very much. We will reconvene in at 10:30.